I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Earlier this year, Doris Gregory, at the age of 93, became a first-time author when Ronsdale Press published her memoir, How I Won the War for the Allies, One Sassy Canadian Soldier's Story. It's a charming book about her life 70 years ago when she fought gender discrimination at the University of British Columbia, and then when she joined the Canadian Women's Army Corps, which took her to across the Atlantic during World War II. It's a book about service and war from the perspective of someone who was there to witness what war was like at the ground level, if you will. Though her work was largely in an office, she managed to make an adventure out of it, traveling through southern England, the Midlands, and Scottish lowlands, even into Ulster. It's a great read and worth discussing as we mark Remembrance Day this week. Doris Gregory joins me now, and I'll get her to tell us about her part in the war effort, how many made up the SEAWACS, and the humor and optimism that leavened her war years. Doris Gregory was born Doris Filmer Bennett here in Vancouver, interrupting her studies at UBC to enlist. After the war, she returned to UBC for a couple of degrees in psychology and was awarded a fellowship to the University of Minnesota, taught briefly at the University of New Hampshire, and later worked for many years as a school psychologist in Ontario. She studied at the Clark Institute of Psychiatry in Toronto to hone her clinical skills before opening an independent practice in Aurora. This is a great book. Do get it. It's a great view onto this war and the war experience that's worth reading. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Doris Gregory. Ms. Gregory, good morning.
Good morning, Joe.
Thanks for joining us.
Well, I'm delighted to be here.
So I've heard Americans refer to WACS. In your case, I shouldn't call you a Canadian WAC. It's really SEAWAC, right?
No, it's not.
No, it's not?
It's the Canadian Women's Army Corps.
Ah, I see.
Yeah, the WACS, you know, the Americans weren't even in the war when our corps was formed. And SEAWACS sound too American. No, we were the Canadian Women's Army Corps, the Quacks. You know, like the sound that duck makes?
Yeah, quack, quack, quack. I see. Yeah. So how many made up the numbers in terms of how many women were part of the Women's Army Corps?
A total of about 21,600, maybe something like that.
I see.
But very few of us got overseas. I was one of the lucky ones. Only about 3,000 of us got overseas.
And you start the book about your university experience, which I found quite interesting because there's a lot of recognizable names there, names that we'd only recognize as buildings nowadays, people like Freddie Wood, Walter Cage. So you didn't, when your experience at UBC was you found that it wasn't a good experience in terms of how the classes were made up in terms of gender, right?
Yes. There was, in second year English, we had a survey course that was mandatory. Everybody taking an arts degree had to attend this course, had to take this course. And the men ended up with all the senior professors. The women were given the professors at the lowest rung of the academic ladder, the lecturers and assistant professors and so on. And we were paying the same fees and everything, but we were not allowed to attend the men's classes.
And then the other thing that I found quite interesting was that the TAs and the sort didn't have access to the exam materials.
Oh, right. Yeah. Even the Dean of Women, who was also an assistant professor in the English department, she told me years later that she was not, none of the juniors were allowed to see the exams that were about to be given to the students.
Yeah.
So, of course, the male professors could coach their students to the exams.
Yeah.
And I always wondered, I had always wondered why I had such trouble even getting a first in English, and it was my best subject. But of course, they used the bell curve, and mm-hmm. we were shortchanged.
Yeah. And so you took to campaigning against this. I guess you were working, you were writing in the UBC at the time, right?
Yeah, I was working as a Cub reporter, and Pierre Burton was my editor. There were two issues, Tuesdays and Fridays, and I was with the Tuesday issue, and Pierre Burton was senior editor. And so I complained to him about this situation. Well, what happened was that, you see, each professor taught the area that was his specialty. It was a survey course. So in the fall, there were two male professors teaching in the male classes. And then in January, there was a different professor. Mm-hmm. Well, the two in the fall, they were, I guess, more tolerant, and they allowed the 10 girls who had a course conflict to attend, as a special consideration, to attend the male classes for one lecture a week, because they had a course conflict.
Mm-hmm.
But come January, and Professor Freddie Woodstern, he said that they could not attend under any circumstances, so they were going to have to miss one lecture a week.
Yeah.
But so one of the girls complained to me in my capacity as a reporter in the UBC, and I talked to Pierre about it, and I said, you know, that's not fair. And he said, well, go crash one of the men's classes. Well, I was going to do it by myself,
mm-hmm.
so I took the 10 girls who were having to be having to miss the lecture, the 10 girls concerned, plus 10 other girls with me, and we sat at the back row of this tiered classroom. And when Professor Wood walked in, he started to lecture, and then he looked up and he saw us, and he said, I am not accustomed to lecturing to young women in this class. All such young women will kindly vacate the room at once.
Hmm.
So we went out, and the men hissed and booed. But I got over to the publications office and said to Pierre, we got thrown out. He said, great, there's your story. Write it up. So we ran it on the front page, and it subsequently got picked up by Canadian University Press, and some reference to it appeared in almost every university paper across the country. So I had a bit of revenge, but it didn't change much.
Yeah.
Professor Wood kind of weaseled his way out of the whole thing and said, oh, he just thought that those were silly students up there. He didn't realize exactly who was there. And, of course, if these any young women who had a legitimate right to be there, by which he meant those with the course conflict, of course they could attend. Well, they, you know, this is ridiculous because he had already told them they couldn't.
Yeah.
But, so that's all I accomplished, really, is that those girls managed to get treated more fairly, but it didn't make any difference to the rest of the, you know, the system. And I only discovered years later, as a matter of fact, when I was just about a year ago or a year or two ago, that the same terrible situation existed in the math department.
Mm.
Now, Professor Wood had made the excuse when I went back to get his reaction to the whole thing. He made the excuse that there were certain things in English literature which simply could not be discussed in mixed classes. Well, I wondered what the, you know, I rather wonder what the excuse Walter Gage had. I mean, I never thought of math as being a very sexy subject, except maybe for the bell curve, if you spell it B-E-L-L-E.
Did you always want to write? Was that the goal?
Yeah. Yeah. I was just, I don't know, 7 or 8 when I announced to my family I was going to be a writer. But then I got sidetracked.
Mm-hmm.
Well, sidetracked for many years because this is my first book I've just published now.
Right, yeah. So so in the middle of your time at UBC, I guess you enlisted. This was during the war, I guess, right?
Well, what happened was that, it was, what happened on the campus. Things were changing. I enjoyed that first 1940 to 41 writing for the UBC. But then towards the end of that year, everything started to change, and more people were leaving, more and more of the men were leaving to join the Army or Air Force, join the forces or mm-hmm. Navy. And the whole atmosphere on the UBC paper changed. It became very quick, and I didn't get the promotion that I thought I deserved, that I wanted. Uh-huh. And the next year, you know, I was felt as if I was kind of in a backwater, and all the excitement was elsewhere, you know. On campus, it just seemed sort of, I don't know, I lost interest. Uh-huh. And I also needed, I have personal reasons for needing to get away from home. And I also had felt rather on the fringe of things for most of my life. I never felt as if I really fitted in. And it occurred to me that if I were to join the Army, I'd be wearing the same uniform as everybody else, and I'd be in the same routines, and I also have some chance for adventure and travel. So that's what I did.
Yeah. And so you do some training in Victoria, and then you end up in Britain. What sort of work did you do? I mean, I mentioned in the introduction it was sort of office work. Is that what you did for most of your time?
Yeah, clerical work, and some of it was extremely boring.
I'll bet, yeah.
In Victoria, they gave me a 4-month clerk course. I had a really nice summer because we didn't have to work too hard. And, you know, I was doing some typing and also taking a course in typing and shorthand. Got my speed up on my typing. But I literally wasn't long enough to be very good at my shorthand. So when they sent me up to Nanaimo, to a military hospital in late September, I only lasted one day as a stenographer because I had to, the surgeon came in and dictated his operating notes to me. Well, with my limited shorthand and all that unfamiliar medical terminology, it took me 2 hours to produce the result for him, and he was so disgusted. He said, "This is absolute gobbledygook." So I was thereupon reduced from the title of stenographer down to clerk typist.
So you were in London for the Blitz, right?
No, not for the Blitz. This was 1942, the fall of 42. The Blitz was really in 40-41.
I see, okay.
You know, I think it started in the fall of 41, yep.
Yeah.
But I did experience a number of air raids.
So what's that like? Because we hear about that a lot, and you know, we see that depicted in films and the sort, mm-hmm. but you experienced that. I mean, was it frightening?
I was never, it's strange. I guess I was too young and silly to be scared. And I felt sort of like it was though I were a news correspondent. It was exciting. And here I was where history was being made, and it was thrilling, but I don't really remember being frightened. excuse me. My very first air raid was, I'd only been in London about 2 weeks, and, you know, walking along the street with my friend and friends and a couple of soldiers, and we were just chatting, and all of a sudden we heard the siren. We just kept walking, and the soldiers were used to it. They didn't react. And then, you know, the noise of the bombers, we could hear the planes coming, and it got louder and louder, and then the ACACs went off, the anti-aircraft batteries, and the noise became absolutely deafening. And then we'd see the searchlights crisscrossing the sky and see a plane caught in the light where the intersection of the lights occurred, and flak bursting around the plane. And then we suddenly realized that the street was almost empty. People were running for shelter, so we ran too. And down in the shelter, it really became quite cozy. People were singing, "There'll Always Be an England."
Yeah.
And I just found it exciting.
Yeah. And so the other thing that I found quite interesting in the book was your depiction of what life was like in England in your time there. The pub scene was pretty good, wasn't it?
Oh, yes. The pub scene was great. You know, the pubs were very, I don't know, friendly sort of places. And in Canada, well, I had really never been in a, what we call a beer parlor. Uh-huh. In those days, but over in England, the pubs were kind of family affairs in a way. Everything was very, very friendly and jovial, and a lot of singing, and you met a lot of people. London was very exciting. You met people from all over the world.
The other thing that I got out of it was that in your telling of what civilian life was like, mm-hmm. in England, you talk about the people, because I guess you had to live with families and the sort, right?
No. We were in barracks by ourselves.
Oh, I see. Okay.
We were located in barracks. But no, what I, my experience with civilian life there, with the life of the civilians, happened when I went on leave.
I see. And then you were...
A number of leaves. Yeah. The English people were so good to us, so hospitable. And if you wanted to go to a certain part of England and you wanted to, you know, stay with a family on leave, you just went to the Sally Ann, the Salvation Army, or the Knights of Columbus, or any of those canteens, and they'd have a list of people who were opening their homes to troops. And so you just... filled out this little form and off you went. And I visited some really, really interesting places. But I was really sorry for the people because they were much worse off than we were. Mm-hmm. I mean, in London, we were in centrally heated barracks. But I remember our first leave I went on up in Aberdeen, we were... even thought of going to Aberdeen in February, I don't know. Very cold when that wind was blowing off the North Sea there. But we stayed with a couple of spinster ladies who were very, very welcoming to us in a little stone cottage. And the main floor of the house was very comfortable. But you went up to the second floor and there was no heat. So we formed the habit, whenever we went on leave like this, we would keep all our, in the wintertime, we would just get under the covers with all our clothes and undress under the covers and sleep with our clothes there and in the morning dress under the covers. Fortunately, our uniforms were excellent and did not crease very much.
Mm. So in your depiction of the pub scene and the sort of the social life that soldiers had in Britain, would you tell us about some of the hijinks that you servicemen and women got into? I mean, was there a lot of necking and things like that?
There were sure, but you know, it was very what shall I say? Well, I have to tell you that my editor's husband said to her, "What does she mean? She spent 3 years over in England and she never had sex?" And I'm just, you know, I'm amazed that nobody realizes what life was like for women in the 40s.
Yeah.
We were absolutely terrified of getting pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you did, you risk getting a dishonorable discharge. You would not dare go home, really. And there were some very, very sad stories as a result of all that. One of the worst experiences was when we were down in, I was stationed in Farnborough. This was a camp that was really a huge military camp, in the middle of which there was our company with 100 girls. And it was I had a lovely summer down there because here we were with thousands of good-looking young soldiers wanting to take us out and take us to dances and have us come to their camps for dances and so on. There were a few girls that got pregnant, but very few, a very small percentage, actually. But one afternoon, when we arrived back from dinner, we were told to put on our pajamas and parade over to the nurse's office, which was, we were in a, it's hard to describe really, we were in a barrack square. This was the old married quarters for the British Army. And on two sides there were row houses that we were in, and then right across the bottom of that that square, there were the offices, the orderly room, the nurse's office, and so on. So here we were lined up across the parade ground and up the stairs to the nurse's office. And Margaret, who was just a woman who was one of our oldest quacks, I think she was about 36, she was just ahead of me. And when she came out of that nurse's office, she was just livid. She stomped on the stairs. And, you know, afterwards, I found out what happened when she went in. See, we had to lay on a table and have our stomachs prodded to see if we were pregnant. But they didn't tell us this was what they were doing. And there was a cocky little officer there, this guy. Well, he looked as if he was fresh out of high school, but I guess he did have a medical degree. And the nurse. And so Margaret had said to him, "I'd like to know what this is all about." And he said, "Oh, come out over to my office one day next week, and I'll show you what it's all about." So she was absolutely furious, and she told him off. She risked charge of insubordination. She said, "I'll have you know I'm a respectable married woman. I have an 18-year-old daughter." Actually, the two of them had joined up over in England. They were Canadians, but they were living in England at the time the war started. So, you know, that was a very undignified kind of experience for us. And but it's something that nobody ever talked about afterwards.
Yeah.
I've been to numerous reunions. Nobody ever mentioned it.
Yeah, but you did have a couple of beaux, did you not? You had a couple of callers, a gentleman calling on you. Did you?
Oh yes, I have boyfriends. I had a lot of dates. We all had a lot of dates, but you know, the Canadian soldiers, I felt much safer really for the Canadian soldiers, because they were more respectful. The Americans were a mixed bag. Some of them, you risked a wrestling match, but some of them were gentlemen, and, you know, a wide range. But with the Canadian soldiers, sure, I had a lot of dates, but there were really only two or three men that I was really fond of. Well, one was a fellow who had been my boyfriend at the University of BC, and he got overseas before me, and we had been sort of girlfriend and boyfriend, but then we broke up when he left to join the service, but we remained good friends. And when I was in London, the whole time I was in England, I used to see him, every maybe 4 or 5 weeks or so. He'd come up to London and take me out dinner and so on, or and then when I moved down to the south of England, south of London, I used to see him occasionally. And he was very helpful in giving me tips and things to watch out for, and some of the trips that the ruses that the soldiers adopted, like some of them would get fake pay books. And, they get a blank pay book somehow or other. and they'd make it out to appear that they were single when they were actually married.
Uh-huh.
This kind of thing went on.
Yeah.
But we girls, things like that spread like wildfire in the Army, and we girls soon became pretty aware of this sort of thing. But I think a lot of English girls were trapped by it, and they thought that this guy was, that they were really engaged, and it turned out the fellow had a wife and a couple of kids back in Canada.
Yeah.
But, Kim was a good friend of mine, and there was another fellow, Trev. Trev turned out to be married, but we were just friends, but really good friends, and we did become very fond of each other. And there were certainly several people that I met that, you know, if the war hadn't got in the way, I could have fallen in love with, I guess.
Now, Trevor, he was the guy that reminded you of Paul Henry from Now Voyager, is that right?
Yes. I met him down on one of these educational leaves I went on. This was something we had an opportunity to do, and I was so starved for intellectual stimulation, I sought out every opportunity to go on something like this. This was at the University of Southampton's navigation school, and we were taken on tours all around the area. We were entertained on board a battleship, and we were also entertained at Mount Batten Estate.
Mm-hmm.
It was a really, really interesting week. Well, the second day there, in marched a platoon of Canadian soldiers, a couple of platoons of Canadian officer cadets, and they were just sent there to have, I guess, some intellectual stimulation, and that is where I met Trev, and I remember I'll always associate the film Now Voyager with Trev, because in some ways our relationship had some overtones of that kind of bittersweet romance.
Yeah.
He was very true to his wife, and we never forgot that he had a wife back home. But we enjoyed each other's company tremendously. I saw a great deal of Trev.
And then when did you meet Reggie?
Oh, that was towards the end. Yeah, that was, around June of 45. Yeah, the end of June towards... Well, I had met him vaguely before because he was a member of our sergeant's mess, but I just seen him in the distance, really. And then, I guess around May or June, he broke up with this English girl he'd been engaged to for 3 years, and then I started taking me out. At first, I wasn't interested in him at all. I thought he was too old, of course, to me at then. Then anybody 30 or over was ancient, but
yeah.
And he looked to be about 30. Actually, he was a little bit younger than that. But somehow or other, after I got talking to him, I found him quite fascinating, and I fell madly in love with him, or thought I was madly in love with him. So,
yeah.
Find out what happened. You really have to read the book.
We do, yeah. I'm 32, and
right.
And people of my culture, of our culture, I should say today, younger generation. Did you think we think enough or recognize the service of our veterans, and not just on November 11th?
I think that I'm just amazed at how little people seem to know about World War II,
mm-hmm.
and particularly about the women's part in World War II. On the other hand, I've been pleasantly surprised with the enthusiastic way my book has been received, even by younger people. Of course, the people who are most interested are the ones who who are have lost or about to lose their parents, and you know, the people who are now in their 50s or 60s, mm-hmm. or some of the people who have really interested in my book are people who were born during the war, you know, in England, and maybe they were 4 or 5 or quite young when the war ended, but they still remember some of this, and they're really interested in it takes them back, they say, you know, the interest in the details that I go into about life in London particularly.
What do you reflect upon when it's Remembrance Day, when it's the 11th of November?
Well, I often think about about the times we had and what it was like, and about my friends. Of course, I've lost all of my old Army buddies. I just have one left. She's the woman who took the picture, the cover picture.
Oh, yeah.
A number of the other pictures, and the woman who accompanied me on our Irish adventure. By the way, we didn't just go to Ulster. Mm-hmm. Our big adventure was we sneaked across the border into the Irish Republic, where we were forbidden to go.
Yep.
Of course, because we were forbidden to go there, we wanted to go.
they were, I guess they were neutral during the war, were they not?
Yes, they were. Yeah.
And then they thought they were spies.
Well, sure, because you see, the border there, I guess it must have been pretty hard to patrol, actually. But because there it was a neutral country and there was a German embassy there, they were always on guard about spies maybe coming up from the south into Ulster. But when we sneaked into the country, but then of course we had to sneak out again. And when we cycled from the border up to Belfast at night, and we had no lights in our bicycles. Of course, you didn't have to worry about traffic. There wasn't any traffic.
Mm-hmm.
But we were stopped and interrogated by patrols 21 times between the border and Belfast.
Wow.
Yeah, it was. At first, we were a little alarmed, but you know, we just lied our way up. I mean, we denied having been across the border, of course, and said we'd been spending our leave in the mountains of Mourne, where we did get lost. That was a very exhausting night because those, you know, the mountains are quite hilly.
Yeah, but it's an exciting chapter in this book. And I'm sure people will want to pick it up for that and for all the other stories that you tell. You're continuing to write. Will there be another book? Because you're just a great storyteller, Doris.
Well, thank you very much. People are asking me that. Now, when's the sequel coming out? But no, Joe, I think I'm just a one-book wonder. It was such hard work writing it. Not so much the writing, but then all that came after with the editing.
Mm-hmm.
And the fine-tuning, it was really a tremendous amount of work.
Yeah, but it must be nice, though, to have it between its covers, and people are reading it, and people are commenting on it, and it, as you said, it has been well-received, hasn't it?
Yes, oh yes, I'm really thrilled at how well it's being received.
Yeah, and your friends and your family, I'm sure they like having the story told to them this way, don't they?
Oh, I think so. I think so.
Yeah.
They're quite surprised that I think that I got it done.
Yeah.
Well, but I have a tremendous sense of accomplishment now I have that book in my hands. And I'm very, very grateful to my publisher because he and my book designer, well, there were so many people that helped me. But he and my book designer, I think, are ultimately responsible for how the book looks. And to me, they've just done a tremendous job.
They did, yeah. I do hope you continue to write, and I hope we'll continue to read you because, you know, as I said, you are a good storyteller, and the book ends at the end of the war, but, you know, your life obviously didn't, and I'm sure you've got more stories, Doris.
Well, I don't know that the rest of my life is terribly exciting, but there are. I may do a few magazine articles or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, the war itself was a great story.
Yeah.
Regardless.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, Doris, thank you for your service, and thank you for this book. It, as I said off the top, it's such a delightful read, and I hope more people pick it up.
Well, thank you ever so much, Joe. I'm very grateful to you.
Well, thank you very much. The book is called How I Won the War for the Allies, One Sassy Canadian Soldier's Story. It's a really great book. People ought to pick it up because not just because it's we're in this period of the year where we take a moment or two to remember the fallen and the sacrifice of our servicemen and women, but it's just a great story. And as I said, Ms. Gregory is a wonderful storyteller. It's from Ronsdale Press. Doris Gregory joined me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.